At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Another first Friday of the month, another set of gloomy figures from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate zoomed past 9% in May. It hasn't been that high since the year Thriller debuted on MTV. For the youngins, that would be 1983. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at trustedchoice.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the fifth day of June. 345,000 people lost their jobs last month. Now, the pace of layoffs is slowing, but the Labor Department reports the unemployment rate now stands at 9.4%. Want to hear the scary part? Well, remember those bank stress tests? The unemployment rate used in their so-called worst-case scenario was a mere 8.9%. Oops. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more from North Carolina Public Radio.
The May jobs report was nasty, especially if you happen to be one of the thousands of people who lost a job last month, or one of the 6 million already out of work since this recession began. Economist Mike England at Action Economics says with the unemployment rate approaching 9.5%,
it's possible by the end of the year we could be up in the 10.4% area. The record for the post-World War II period is a 10.8% unemployment rate, so we seem to be taking a run at that figure.
But May's job losses were much lower than what economists expected. And this is the fourth straight month that jobless claims have declined. Some industries, like healthcare, hospitality, and education, actually added jobs. Economist Mark Vidner at Wachovia Corporation says the numbers reflect basic business logistics.
Businesses cut so deeply earlier in the year that they don't need to cut so much right now. And so we're seeing that the pace of layoffs is slowing, but there's no pickup in hiring yet.
Vidner says a strong uptick is at least a year off, even though he predicts the recovery will begin in a few months. So how does the economy get out of this mess if people keep losing their jobs? Joel Naroff at Naroff Economic Advisors says it does happen.
Businesses can produce more with the same number of workers. The simplest way, of course, to do it is to work them longer, have them do overtime.
That would mean the economy's growing, even if jobs are being lost. It's how we got out of the last two recessions. Naroff says it could work again this time. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We know a little more today about how General Motors is putting our tax dollars to work. You know, those $30 billion the bankrupt carmaker will get in loans from Uncle Sam. The Wall Street Journal reported today that GM will be turning over a sizable chunk of our money to a private equity firm, which will then use the cash to buy GM's primary parts supplier, Delphi. Wait, what? We asked senior business correspondent Bob Moon to sort it out for us.
The idea of a leveraged buyout is nothing new, but a leveraged bailout? Beverly Hills-based Platinum Equity reportedly will put up no more than $750 million to buy the bankrupt parts supplier. Bill Visnick is senior editor at Edmunds Auto Observer. He says the rest will apparently come from taxpayers by way of GM, more than $2.5 billion.
There's no question that to get GM fixed and get GM sort of charted on the right path towards working again, there was no way you were going to have that happen or no way you're going to enable that without also getting Delphi healthy, basically.
Delphi was a division of GM until it was spun off in 1994. It's pretty much languished ever since, but Visnick says GM still depends on it.
You can't just have that supplier go away because you don't have any other alternatives. There's no one you can call on the phone and say, hey, Monday morning, we need you to start supplying this radiator module for us, because the system simply isn't set up to work that way.
While that much may be true, some industry watchers wonder if there isn't some other way. Presumably, the government funding for a loan this size is, shall we say, more attractive than current market rates. And at Case Western University, economics professor Susan Helper wonders if taxpayers might benefit from a more straightforward approach.
There could have been, you know, perhaps direct government involvement that would come with Delphi, you know, that the government shares in the upside if this actually works.
It's not a done deal yet. The arrangement must still receive a bankruptcy court's approval. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So you've got U.S. automakers on life support and the nation's economy shedding hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. It's the new normal, isn't it? Shows how far we've come from the simple life back in, '07. Just about everything being done to fix the economy depends in part on a real estate rebound. But it turns out the housing numbers we hear every month do not tell the whole story. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
Banks are holding hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes. When house prices rise, the banks will release those cheap houses onto the market and potentially send prices right back down again. Andrew Jakubowicz is a housing expert with the Center for American Progress.
There are about 500,000 properties that have been taken in foreclosure that have not yet made their way onto the listings of properties that are available for sale.
The banks are doing this because they think they'll get a better offer on the houses if they wait. It's a delicate balance because empty homes don't do anyone much good.
The properties sort of sit vacant and abandoned on some level, and often the vacancy attracts blight and crime. People will break in. People will start squatting. It really impairs the value of the properties.
As much as 10%, he says. Louis Goodkin is a housing consultant in Miami. He says prices are also threatened by the people who are buying the bulk of the houses on the market right now. Half of South Florida's sales, he says, are going to investors who are just looking for a quick profit.
An awful lot of the stuff that's being sold, foreclosed properties, is being sold to speculators, investors, that when the market comes back, those people are going to be out there trying to sell that product.
That means even more houses on the market, which Goodkin says could drag prices down another 10%. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And a couple of corrections to note. In our story yesterday about the new Palm Pre, we mistakenly said Palm offered the first PDA and that the Pre is the first smartphone to offer a touchscreen and a separate keyboard. As many of you pointed out, neither was a first. Also yesterday, we said there were 1.5 million young people out of work in Cairo. We meant to say in all of Egypt. Wall Street ignored the jobs news today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, President Obama continued his tour of the Middle East and Europe. He's talking a lot about cooperation with the Muslim world and with Germany, a country he dubbed a critical partner. Cooperation is a cornerstone of his foreign policy. Sounds commonsensical. But commentator K.C. Cole says the idea also has some grounding in math.
Whether we like to admit it or not, much of the financial mess we're in was caused by the credo that greed helps everyone, that looking out for number one is practically our patriotic duty. And yet, most of us routinely help each other out even when we don't have to. We tip waiters, give up our seats on the bus, subscribe to public radio. This unexpected streak of altruism shows up even in situations where conflict is the point. Enemy soldiers facing each other in trenches during World War I often made tacit agreements to live and let live. It's also true in times of stress. During the Great Depression, sharing was at an all-time high. So why do people so often go against what seems to be their own self-interest? A branch of mathematics called game theory has found that, in fact, cooperative strategies seem to prevail in computer matches designed to reveal what makes a winner. Surprisingly, the top dog turns out to be not the most consistently ruthless, but the one who reciprocates in kind. Math really does prove the golden rule. To be successful, do unto others what you would have others do unto you. The condition is, or else. If you're nice and the competition retaliates, then you have to retaliate right back. If you don't, you're a sucker. But forgiveness is part of the equation, too. There must also be an expectation that the two sides will interact another day. And let's face it, we're all in this economic melting pot together. Unless you're ready to flee to Antigua, best to cooperate. Competition does keep us on our toes, but when competition means obliterating everyone, then the predator, in effect, eats all its prey. If Wall Street speculators suck up so much money that businesses die and no one can sell or buy products or pay taxes, everybody loses. Just do the math.
Casey Cole is a professor at the Annenberg School at USC. Her latest book is The Universe and the Teacup. We want your feedback. Write to us at marketplace.org. Man, this seems like a really long week, doesn't it? GM declared bankruptcy on Monday, and it seems like that was months ago. Maybe that's because we were all expecting it, or maybe it's because there were plenty of other items on the docket this week. The Treasury Secretary was in China, and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testified before Congress.
Even as we take steps to address the recession and threats to financial stability, maintaining the confidence of the financial markets requires that we as a nation begin planning now for the restoration of fiscal balance.
Joining us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond are Megan McArdle of The Atlantic's Business Channel and Felix Salmon at Reuters. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Tess.
You heard the Fed chairman suggesting earlier this week that the worst was behind us, and then he turned right around and warned of all these problems ahead if we keep borrowing and spending, two things that we continue to do a lot of. So, Megan, you know, we talked about those little green shoots sprouting up this spring, signs of optimism. What happened to those after Bernanke's remarks?
Well, as far as I can tell, the market has completely ignored what Bernanke said and gone on merrily on its way. So the green shoots seem to still be impressive enough to at least produce something of a rally in the stock markets.
Felix, you agree?
Well, I think that the green shoots were largely illusory at the best of times. Mm. And that Bernanke was basically saying to anyone who's looking at the stock market and saying that things are recovering, there's many, many things which can go spectacularly wrong over the medium term.
I guess maybe they're really looking at these short-term indications. You know, you have unemployment did not drop as much as previous months, and, you know, the housing market seems to be picking up, but...
Yeah, this is one of my favorite pieces of optimism, where people look at the second derivative of the unemployment numbers. They don't look at how enormously high it is. They don't say, it's 9.4%, that's horrible. Instead, they look at the difference between the number of people who lost their jobs in May and the number of people who lost their jobs in April.
In April, right.
And they say, ooh, things are turning around. And this is just never convincing to me.
We're all looking for it, aren't we?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I hope there's no one out there who's rooting for the economy to underperform. But I think that there's certainly a lot of bear analysts who are looking at this and just don't see how it can possibly be sustained. The United States has gigantic fiscal problems coming down the pike. The Fed has ballooned its balance sheet to a point where at some point soon it's got to start disgorging some of this massive buildup. And where is the secular growth coming from? Where is the new growth going to come from in the world economy? It's not really clear to me, and I think to a lot of other people.
Let's talk a little bit about Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's trip to China this week. You know, Ben Bernanke's here warning us about, you know, paying attention to fiscal sustainability. What do you make of Geithner's trip and these efforts to boost China's confidence in buying our debt? Felix?
It's a necessary trip because the Chinese hold, depending on who you believe, somewhere in the region of $2 trillion worth of U.S. debt. And if they lose confidence in that debt, then that would spell disaster for the bond markets. And as Bill Clinton famously said, we're all enthralled to the bond markets. We basically have to do exactly what they say. So the good news is, however, that the Chinese don't really have much choice. If they want to export their way out of their own current slowdown, then they have to basically continue to do what they've been doing all along, which is provide vendor finance and keep on throwing lots of dollars back at the US. It's a kind of game where neither country can really blink, even though neither of them on its own is doing something which makes a lot of sense. The US should be borrowing much less money, as Megan says, although it's a recession and it doesn't have a huge amount of choice.
Megan, your thoughts?
Well, I think you've got a couple of different concerns here. I absolutely agree with Felix that it's a recession. We should be borrowing money. That said, the magnitude is vaster than anything we've done before. And there's a real question to me about whether, even if it had the will, China would be able to absorb the kinds of deficits that we may be looking at over the next few. I mean, you know, 20% of U.S. GDP over a couple of years, right? So that's one real issue. And I think the second question, which is how stable is China? Their economy is to some extent a black box. And how much longer can they continue to generate the kind of cash they've been throwing abroad? I'm not sure anyone really knows.
And on that note of uncertainty, as always, Megan McArdle, Felix Salmon, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, what makes a ripping financial read?
The reader identifies with characters. The context seems to be real, whether he's writing about the French Revolution or about the failure of Lehman Brothers.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street could not get excited about much today. The Dow Jones picked up 0.1%, 12 points, to close at 8,763. The Nasdaq traded flat, closing at 1849. And the S&P 500 forfeited 0.25%, 2 points, to finish at 940. A so-so day, but pretty good week. The Dow bulked up 3.1%. The Nasdaq padded on 4.2%. And the S&P 500 ended the week 2.3% ahead. Financial stocks had a down day. Citigroup lost 3% on reports that federal regulators want to increase their control of the bank. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.83%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. It's a day to think about that giant body of water we eat from and swim in. June 8th is World Oceans Day. In Fairfax, Virginia, high school students study really hard during the annual USA Biology Olympiad National Finals. And believe it or not, paying at the pump was more painful a year ago. The average price of regular hit $4 a gallon. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. We heard earlier about how unemployment numbers are giving mixed signals about an economic recovery. Well, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reported this week about a slew of issues facing state unemployment benefits. Many are running out of money, some are already billions in debt, and that could spell disaster down the road for businesses in the form of higher taxes. The unemployed could see their benefits cut as well. Mitchell joins us now to take a forward look at unemployment programs across the country. Hey, Mitchell.
Hi, Tess.
Let's start with unemployment benefits and the stimulus package. Explain how these two are related and what it means for the economy if all these benefits are cut.
First of all, keep in mind, $64 billion will go to states from the federal government to help them pay unemployment benefits this year. That is not normal. The federal government usually steps in a recession and extends benefits, gives people another 26 weeks, sometimes as long as another year. That's what's happened now. But in addition, the stimulus package had a lot of extra money for states to extend their benefits, to pay extra benefits. And, you know, I hear a lot of people say, where's my stimulus? I've heard about the stimulus. Where's my stimulus? Well,
right.
This is one of those examples where it's going directly into the economy. People who get unemployment checks boosted by the federal government, they're going to spend that money right away on rent, on food, on keeping their car. So you see that impact of that money going from the federal government right into local economies. Economists think twice as much impact from that as tax cuts.
You explained in your piece on Wednesday that states developed these unemployment systems back in the 1930s. And of course, as we know, a lot has changed since then. How are states working to address some of these issues that must be coming up now when you use this ancient system to try to address what's going on with modern families?
In the New Deal, it was meant mainly to address single wage earners, mostly men, mostly worked the same factory year after year, and then suddenly the factory shut its doors. Nowadays, so many workers are part-time. They're temporary. They're seasonal. A lot of those people don't qualify for benefits. The rules are set up so that if you don't make a certain amount of money in the last 12 months, you don't qualify. And so states are being pushed largely by the federal government to try to modernize their systems and basically add people to the roles who are losing their jobs now and finding that they don't get unemployment benefits.
Well, so with all those factors, are there signs out there that states will be able to bring these programs around before we have a major crisis on our hands?
Well, in the long run, the states that are in deep trouble, and almost all the big states are, you know, California, New York, Indiana, they're going to have to either raise their business taxes or they're going to have to cut benefits. And in a lot of places, cutting benefits is just politically undoable.
Sure.
But right now, nobody wants to do anything. They'll keep borrowing from the federal government to pay their benefits for at least another year or two. Nobody wants to raise taxes right now, and nobody wants to hit the unemployed with any kind of cut in their benefits.
All right. Thanks, Mitchell, for the series and for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Tess.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reported his series on unemployment benefits with ProPublica's Olga Pierce. You can find his reports with an interactive map and slideshows on our website. It's marketplace.org. Summer's near, the time is right for dancing in the streets and picking up a good book for some beach reading. What better way to escape the economic doom and gloom, right? Well, give it another few summers and we may be reading about today's facts in tomorrow's fiction. The Great Depression produced, among other literary giants, John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And some novelists are already at work on books that make our economic story part of the plot. Ashley Milne-Dyett reports.
Therese Flanagan started working on her first novel in 2005. All she knew then was that her heroine would be an art student in Chicago, Flanagan's hometown. But soon the outside world began to infiltrate her plot.
All the social talk was about what's your house worth? How much? Everybody was getting rich the same way. And you knew it had to stop.
She named her novel American Gothic. The housing market hadn't yet crashed, but she'd already decided the fate of one of her characters, the father of the art student. He's a contractor who borrowed like mad to build a 30-story condo building.
All of a sudden, the bankers started calling in their lines of credit, and his world starts to unravel in ways he didn't expect, because he's always been able to fly through. But leverage became the god.
Sound familiar? Flanagan's agent is just starting to shop her book around. She may be among the first wave of writers to weave the latest boom and bust into their fiction. Agents and editors aren't giving much away, but they say real life makes its way into novels. Peter Mayer is president of the Overlook Press. He's worked in publishing for decades.
This will appear in our fiction.
But he says it's not necessarily timely subject matter that hooks readers.
If you're a serious publisher, you publish books because they work. In other words, they are written well. The reader identifies with characters. The context seems to be real, whether he's writing about the French Revolution or about the failure of Lehman Brothers.
Mayer says Tom Wolfe achieved all that 20 years ago with his best-selling novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities. In this extract, the wife of Wall Street bond trader Sherman McCoy tries to explain to their daughter, in a marketplace-y kind of way, how the bond business works.
Just imagine that a bond is a slice of cake, and you didn't bake the cake, but every time you hand somebody a slice of the cake, a tiny little bit comes off, like a little crumb, and you can keep that.
Charlotte Abbott is a contributing editor for Publishers Weekly. She says Bonfire of the Vanities may be the defining novel of the go-go 1980s, but the events and people it described were centered in one place, New York.
But what is the locus of this recession? There's a New York story, there's a Florida story, it has tentacles all over, and it also has international components.
Abbott says there's been so much good nonfiction about the financial crisis, it could give novelists quite a challenge. But a good yarn inspired by fact can resonate long after it's published. Take this scene from the recent PBS series of Charles Dickens' novel Little Dorrit.
Seems he was stealing from one fund to pay another, issuing shares with that collateral, and now it's all blown up and burst. There's nothing left.
It'll probably take a few years of hard work before a modern Madoff character appears on bookstore shelves. As for whether anyone will want to read such novels by then, Peter Mayer says quite possibly.
They'll want to read them if the characters are well drawn, if the plot is meaningful still.
He says given how many lives are being changed by this downturn, those plots could resonate with plenty of readers. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Every other Friday at the end of the program, we take a bit of a break from the big economic news of the week. We send Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan out to ask the Marketplace staff what they'd really like to talk about. News that might have escaped your notice. Something you might like to talk about at a dinner party.
George Judson, Managing Editor of Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, there's a letter-writing campaign protesting the White House vegetable garden.
From, like, the meat industry?
It's from the Crop Life Association. That would be your pesticide industry, because the White House garden is organic, and it doesn't use pesticides.
Where does this end? So is the TV industry going to write letters because you reuse books to our children?
Now that you mention it, I think they might want to.
The lap band industry will get upset because she exercises?
Well, as this association says, what message does this send?
New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, as if farmers don't have it hard enough as it is, now they're going to be replaced by robots.
For real?
For real. This week, New Scientist reports the military has developed technology that allows robots to do things like spray chemicals on trees and...
Does that seem frightening to you?
Maybe a little bit.
I mean, did we learn nothing from the film 2001?
Right. I'm afraid I can't let you do that, Dave.
I'm afraid these strawberries are mine, Dave.
I'm afraid you have to pay me more than $5 an hour, Dave, to pick your crops.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Japan is actually using comedians to train some of its bureaucrats.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's hoping that that will help make them better managers.
Government employees who think they're funny. This could be a complete disaster.
Yeah, knock, knock. Who's there? Audit.
Or you go to DMV and there's like a brick wall behind the guy and a stool with a glass of water on it. Bi-weekly street cleanup. What's up with that?
That's just a taste of Rico and Brendan's podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and there's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 12 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ traded flat, and the S&P 500 dropped 2 points, 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, here's when living frugally hits big time.
Turns out we'd only averaged a combined income of $41,000 a year for the last 10 years. The killer, though, is that we've been living, for the most part, as if we've been making $100,000 a year.
Uh-oh. I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.